This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Children's Wisconsin recently opened up a walk-in mental health clinic. We'll find out how the clinic fits into efforts to meet the mental health needs of children and teens. Now, U.S. officials and others are concerned about potential war crimes being committed by Russia in its war on Ukraine. On Friday, Vice President Kamala Harris called on the International Criminal Court to investigate whether Putin has violated international law in his attacks in Ukraine.
Absolutely, there should be an investigation, and we should all be watching. And I have no question the eyes of the world are on this war and what Russia has done in terms of this aggression and these atrocities.
Vice President Harris pointed to video footage that came out late last week appearing to show a Ukrainian maternity hospital struck by a Russian missile. Prosecuting war crimes isn't as simple as gathering footage from the war zone, and the U.S. is in a complicated position with Russia and the International Criminal Court. Our guests today are experts on war crimes, international law, and political behavior. They're here with us to help us better understand what could happen with Russia and Putin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about war crimes? Do you want to see Putin prosecuted for his attacks in Ukraine? What kind of punishment do you think would be appropriate? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jessica Wolfendale is a professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at Marquette University. She's co-author of the book War Crimes, Causes, Excuses, and Blame. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Mark Berlin is an assistant professor of political science, also at Marquette University. He's author of the book Criminalizing Atrocity, The Global Spread of Criminal Laws Against International Crime. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
All right, thanks for having me.
Jessica, let's start with you. Can you talk about the reason that some of the international community came together and tried to say some of these actions during wartime constitute crimes above and beyond the usual things we might see in war?
That's actually quite an interesting question that you end talking about what we normally see in war, because it might seem strange to think that, you know, given that war already involves killing and destruction, some people might already think war is essentially involved in crime, mm-hmm. given that it involves killing and destruction. How do we distinguish between killing and destruction that's permissible in war and killing and destruction that's not permissible in war? So one way to think about the origins of the laws of armed conflict is both coming from a position of recognizing that individuals have fundamental rights that shouldn't be violated even in a context of war, like rights don't magically disappear. And so people who are not engaged in a conflict, such as civilians, have moral rights against being harmed in the course of a conflict. So that's one angle which gives rise to certain kinds of important protections that civilians have under the laws of armed conflict. Another reason, and I think this is also something which can sometimes be hard to reconcile with very aggressive wars like the one we're seeing now, is that maybe part of the goal here is to try and minimize the destruction caused by war. And one way of doing that is saying, look, okay, we recognize that war is always, you know, in essence, destructive, but by imposing constraints that both sides of a conflict are bound to recognize, that at least puts some constraints on the scale and targets of the destruction. So that's a sort of another way of thinking about the purpose of war crimes that really comes from what you might call a pragmatic approach, and combining that with what you might call a sort of moral approach, which says that, again, there are individuals in war who have a moral right not to be harmed. And so we ought to do as much as we can to protect such individuals. But again, there's some, you know, again, it's still a strange situation because, you know, traditionally the way the law has viewed conflict is that soldiers on both sides of a conflict, so even soldiers who are fighting on the manifestly, obviously aggressive, unjust side of a conflict, they actually have the same legal protections as soldiers fighting on the side of justice. So they have, for example, prisoner of war protections. If they surrender, they have to be treated in accordance with the Geneva Conventions. They can't be, for example, put on trial just for fighting in a war. And that seems a little bit strange if you think about something like the situation we're looking at now, where we have one side engaged in, again, a manifestly, very clearly illegal and aggressive war. And so to then say, well, soldiers in that war can somehow still engage in permissible acts seems odd.
Mark, can you talk about the challenges of enforcement? Because in a lot of ways, someone's only going to be charged with the war crime, successfully charged and prosecuted, if they lose the war. If they win, nobody can really enforce that on them. Is that a, kind of a core problem here?
Right. I mean, that's a fundamental dilemma that characterizes most armed conflicts and most attempts at accountability for violations of the laws of war. Under the international laws of war, also known as international humanitarian law or the law of armed conflict, the primary responsibility for accountability for enforcement lies with the national authorities of the perpetrators. So in that case, to the extent that Russia has committed war crimes, the primary responsibility would lie with the Russian judicial system. It seems unlikely that Russia will hold its personnel accountable in any significant way at this point. After that, there are basically two potential avenues for accountability. One is in the criminal courts of other countries, third party countries, under some legal doctrines, it is possible to hold, to prosecute alleged war crimes that happened abroad. This happens occasionally in European countries occasionally do this. There have been cases of Syrian officials being prosecuted in European countries after they have, say, defected from the regime and found themselves in various European countries. Again, one of the issues with that, and this is a fundamental dilemma, again, is gaining custody of the accused. In the cases where we do see foreign prosecutions of war criminals, they're relatively rare, and they happen when perpetrators, like I said, tend to find themselves in other countries for various reasons, because they defected from a regime or they traveled there. So, you know, gaining custody of the accused in that way will be difficult. The other option is prosecutions in international courts, like the Hague-based International Criminal Court or other types of international criminal tribunals that have been set up for particular conflicts. That court faces the same types of dilemmas. The International Criminal Court or courts like it don't have their own police forces, don't have their own military, so they have to rely on the cooperation and assistance of national authorities to go out and apprehend indicted suspects and to transfer them to the court. So it seems, unlikely that, again, that the Russian government or to the extent that the Ukrainian government or Ukrainian forces are also potentially implicated in war crimes, it seems unlikely that they would voluntarily transfer their forces, member personnel, to the International Criminal Court. But you could imagine a few scenarios in which there could be some people who get detained. One would be people who have already been captured as prisoners of war and for whom there is evidence that they are implicated in war crimes. In those cases, say, Ukrainian forces capture Russian personnel and have evidence that they are implicated in war crimes, they could either prosecute them in their own domestic courts, or if the International Criminal Court indicts them, they could transfer them to the court. The other potential scenario that, is less likely, but, there's some glimmer of possibility, is a situation where, we don't know how the war is going to end, but a situation where, say, top Russian officials like the president are indicted by the International Criminal Court. As a condition for relieving sanctions, the broad sanctions that are on Russia right now, as a condition for that, Russia would need to, say, turn over indicted suspects to the court. That doesn't seem, likely, but, there is a kind of historical example of that in the Yugoslav wars with Slobodan Milosevic being turned over by his government in exchange for sanctions relief. It's a very different situation, but there is a kind of precedent for that.
Let's bring on a caller now. Nick is with us in Milwaukee. Nick, hello.
Yeah, hi. I just had a question about specifically the way that we have treaties and war crimes that we've seen the U.S. government and the U.S. military allege things like cluster bombs are war crimes, and humongous amounts of allegations that war crime, something, since something's immoral, it's a war crime. But a lot of countries haven't signed treaties that make some of these munition types illegal, and we have a moral argument that the use of these munitions is a war crime, but really it's not from a legal perspective because there's no treaty actually making them, banning them from combat. So I guess I just wanted your comment on that.
Nick, thanks for the call. Jessica, a particular type of munition, no treaties exist outlawing it. It seems morally wrong. How does that fit into how we measure war crimes?
Well, I mean, it is a war crime to cause disproportionate civilian harm. So even if perhaps cluster bombs or cluster munitions are not yet formally outlawed, the use of them in residential areas would still probably constitute a war crime because it violates a prohibition on causing disproportionate harm to civilians. And so I think there's still a way of thinking of them as war crimes. And I agree with the caller that I think these munitions should be banned under international law if they're not already banned. Because they're essentially indiscriminate. But their very nature means that it's impossible to target them precisely against military targets. But as I said, the use of them can still be classified a war crime because of the way they cause disproportionate civilian harm in residential areas, which seems to be what we're seeing occurring in Ukraine.
Nick, thanks for that call. We're talking about war crimes with Jessica Wolfendale and Mark Berlin. They're both from Marquette University and have both written books on the subject. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Your concerns about what's going on with the Russian attack in Ukraine when it comes to potential war crimes, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Marquette University professors Jessica Wolfendale and Mark Berlin. They're with us today talking about war crimes, how they're prosecuted, what could happen with Vladimir Putin and other Russian leaders. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or your thoughts. 800-642-1234 is the number. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Madison. Bill, hi.
Hi. My concern is also the war crimes that are definitely going on right now. We got, 150,000 plus Ukrainians who wanted to get out of there and crossed into Russia. I can almost guarantee they are locked up right now. Putin already says 15 years for anybody protesting the war. He's looking at anyone who's Ukrainian as an enemy of the state. My concern is, are we going to have Bosnia? Are we going to have World War II show up? Are we going to have other things going on that these people are being tortured? And, you know, Putin already, I mean, it's crazy. And is it going to be too late? They talk about the cost-benefit analysis. I can almost guarantee that these people are being locked up and tortured.
Bill, thanks for the call. Mark, there's what we're seeing on our screens, the hospitals being bombed, residential neighborhoods, as Jessica said. Bill's wondering what we're not seeing. What kind of concerns do you have, and how hard is it to uncover these things, especially in the context of war crimes?
Right. Well, so in terms of visibility and evidence, I mean, one of the remarkable things about this particular conflict is how well documented it is. It is in real time. And that is important for, you know, being able to collect evidence in potential future prosecutions. I talked about the dilemma of apprehending indicted suspects. But one of the other fundamental dilemmas in prosecuting something like war crimes is collecting enough evidence to be able to substantiate responsibility for them, both at the bottom of the command chain and at the top. So the volume of kind of grassroots evidence, if you want to put it that way, in terms of cell phone video and photographs and things like that, represents a distinctive feature of this conflict and is going to be extremely important for potential prosecutions. And there's already a lot of efforts underway to collect that and preserve that kind of evidence. In terms of what might be happening in Russia to civilians that have fled there, I don't know. Under the law, civilians are supposed to be immune from not only physical attack, but also criminal prosecution to the extent that they haven't actually engaged in any war crimes. They are not supposed to be prosecuted or even detained. especially if they are fleeing the conflict zone for safety.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jessica, one thing we've already mentioned, it's gotten a lot of attention, the bombing of a hospital, a maternity hospital, for one. From a war crime perspective, does it matter if the hospital was targeted or if it was hit incidentally as part of military operations? Obviously, the tragedy is the same for the people hit. From a war crime perspective, does it matter if it was intentional?
Well, yes and no. So certainly intentionally targeting hospitals is a violation of laws of armed conflict. But again, so is what we might think of negligent targeting. So even if the hospital wasn't directly targeted, but there was little care taken to avoid harm, then that would also constitute excessive destruction. That's not justified by military necessity, which is itself a violation of the laws of armed conflict. So in either way, there's the firing of, missiles and cluster munitions in areas where there is a hospital there, where it's known there's a hospital there, and where it's highly foreseeable the hospital will be hit. In some ways, at least the moral difference between intentional and unintentional, I think, disappears in that case. And legally, I think there's actually not that much of a difference either, right? That, again, imposing disproportionate and excessive risk on civilians is also a war crime. So even if it's technically unintentional, I think it's safe to say that it still constitutes imposing this excessive risk.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm wondering about the concept of justice, what it means for the world and what it means for the United States. After World War II, America obtained Nazi scientists to work with in their missile program. They were never prosecuted. My Lai incident in Vietnam was covered up for quite a while. And finally, when I believe one person was prosecuted and ultimately had a very light sentence. And we've had drone strikes that have hit civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq. So regardless of the country, but particularly for America, what is justice?
Tom, thanks for the call. Mark, are we too quick to ignore war crimes for, I guess, reasons of political expediency?
Well, that is certainly a constant whenever there's an armed conflict and discussions about responsibility. Given the kind of practical challenges to enforcement and accountability, often it is those who have more power, those who are the winners of a conflict, who have more say in who gets prosecuted and what kinds of crimes are considered. Famously at Nuremberg, the Allies made carve-outs in the jurisdiction or the kinds of crimes that the tribunal was going to focus on to make sure that they couldn't be accused of committing the same things that the Nazi leadership committed. So there's always compromises and cutting corners in the pursuit of justice. It's virtually impossible, or it is impossible, to completely separate politics from justice, even though there's this presumption that justice is supposed to be free from politics. Even with the best intentions, it's impossible to separate political considerations from the pursuit of justice.
Tom, thanks for the call. Oh, go ahead, Jessica.
Sorry, I just wanted to chime in there. Thanks, Tom. I think that's an important question. Mark's absolutely right, but I think Tom's also right to highlight that there's also, hypocrisy on that occurs when we don't like to think of the violence that we've inflicted. So, for example, the civilian deaths caused by drone strikes, we don't like to think of those as being war crimes, although in many ways they share similarities with what we're condemning in Ukraine, or what's being condemned in Ukraine. So I think it's important that we are reflective about, well, if we are condemning these acts of violence in Ukraine, then we ought to look at acts of violence committed by, say, the US military, and if it's of the same kind, then it ought to be condemned in the same way. Now, that's in some ways idealistic, and I don't think that, politically that rarely occurs, but I think it is important to bring that to mind, if for nothing else, and this is actually very important, to do justice to the victims of war crimes that have been committed by US military forces over the decades.
Thanks again for that call, Tom. And just our last minute or so, I wanted to hear from hopefully each of you with time, if you could be brief. Are you hoping, Jessica, that the world will take war crimes more seriously? There will be some sort of, I don't know, moral suasion that can prevent them from happening in the first place?
That's a very complex question. And it depends on what day it is and how optimistic I'm feeling. But part of me does feel a little pessimistic. I think it's great that there is so much outrage about what's happening in Ukraine, because what is happening there is an absolute atrocity. I wish, though, that that outrage did extend to victims of other conflicts, for example, the victims of Syria and other countries in which war crimes have occurred. So I would want, optimistically, I would like to think that the outrage we're seeing now will lead to a greater, more global recognition of the atrocity of war crimes.
And Mark, just in our last few moments, your thoughts on the future of war crime prosecutions?
Yeah. So, I mean, on any given day, you can find instances of war crimes, or, you know, there's conflicts that happen every year. It's interesting that this one has provoked the world to take such an interest in war crimes. And I think it's interesting to think about why that is. What's different about this conflict? Are there objective things that are different, or is it just people's perceptions about it because of, you know, who is involved, how the United States is involved? And so, if anything, I hope that this helps make people more aware of war crimes that happen other places and more concerned with them, and to see these as less extraordinary and more part of, you know, part of how they happen around the world on a regular basis.
We'll leave it there. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jessica, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Jessica Wolfendale, professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at Marquette University, and Mark Berlin, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. They've both written books about war crimes and international law. They were with us today for a look at war crimes and how the international community responds to them, especially in light of the latest news from Ukraine and the Russian invasion there. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, take a tour of Wisconsin's undeveloped lakes around the state and the best water wilderness Wisconsin has to offer. A lot of great lakes out there, some without so much development. Kate's guest has focused and taken a tour all around the state. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, have you ever seen one of those basement toilets that's just kind of there in the middle of nothing? Turns out it's kind of a Wisconsin thing. We'll check out the story behind the freestanding bathroom fixture. Now, earlier this month on Central Time, we talked with the former director of the National Institute of Mental Health about the shortcomings of mental health care in the United States. Children's Wisconsin in Milwaukee has taken a step to fill some of the gaps in service, opening a new walk-in mental health clinic last week. Amy Herbst is vice president of mental and behavioral health for Children's Wisconsin. Amy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What kind of things were you hearing from patients when it came to access or lack of access to mental health care in your part of the state?
So we were hearing from families that it was taking too long to receive the mental health care that their children needed, whether that be a therapist, a psychologist, or a psychiatrist. They were really feeling like they were getting to a place of crisis before they could access the care that they needed.
Can you talk about the process of putting together this walk-in clinic and trying to meet the needs that you were just talking about?
Yes. Yeah, so this clinic is really the direct result of us listening to those kids and families who were telling us they needed more immediate options when it came to caring for their children's mental health. And it also was in response to those providing mental health care were saying, you know, we're doing everything we can, but we can't always be immediately available to families. And sometimes that's exactly what families need. So we've got to create something that was new and different.
So who should come to this clinic and when?
So that's such a great question. So we are really trying to be clear with families about who should come and when they should come. And so we are looking to serve kids and families where they're having new or worsening issues related to anxiety, stress, depression. Maybe they're having a loss of interest in things that the child typically enjoyed. trouble focusing, maybe a loss of appetite that's very concerning, feeling of isolation. Maybe they're having some flare-ups from some mood disorders, sleeping difficulties, difficulties with school, absolutely. And so if those families are feeling like this is urgent, we cannot wait for our therapy appointment. We cannot wait to get off the waiting list. We don't have an emergency here, but we do have an urgent issue. We're telling those families to walk into our walk-in clinic.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that because in talking to, I mentioned the former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, a lot of times that first point of contact with the healthcare system, the mental health system, is that crisis in the emergency room. It sounds like part of the hope here is to deal with that maybe acute problem before it develops into that crisis emergency stage.
Yes, that's exactly what we're hoping to do. And this is one component of a variety of things that we're doing at Children's to try to meet the needs of our kids. So what we're saying is, please come to this walk-in clinic before you find yourself in an emergency and needing to call 911 or go to a psychiatric crisis service or come to our emergency department. Hopefully we can help you sooner.
Talking to Amy Herbst, Vice President of Mental and Behavioral Health for Children's Wisconsin, looking at a new walk-in mental health clinic there. What kind of help does that kid get? They've had their appointment there. What kind of things do you do to help them in the long term?
Sure. So in the long term, what we're able to do is provide a lot of navigation services to families. So immediately you can come to us and we'll assess your situation. We'll do some evaluations. We will meet your immediate urgent needs. And it doesn't stop there. We will stay connected to a family until they are connected to whatever long-term mental health care that they need. So that might be outpatient therapy. That might be a psychiatric evaluation. That might be inpatient hospitalization. Whatever it is, we will see that through with you until you get to where your child needs.
Let's bring on a caller. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Jeremy, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to commend the idea concept of this urgent clinic because psychiatric help for children or people with autism, ADHD, things like that, and everything that's encompassing with those things are so difficult for people to get immediate care and or care within like a 6 month, 7 month time frame. And I'm wondering if they're going to have an expansion maybe to young adults because when you get older, it doesn't go away. You're always going to have autism, ADHD, anxiety issues. What options would they be able to provide possibly in the near future for something like that?
And Jeremy, is this an issue in your family?
Yeah, it is an issue with my family. We struggle so much trying to get just basic, you know, care for my son during his autism and with his autism. And psychiatric help and psychologists, they're just so overburdened, and you never got a chance to really get in there. But 7 months later, whatever happened 7 months ago is moved on to something completely different, you know?
Jeremy, thank you so much for sharing your story and your family story. First of all, Amy, that 6 or 7 month wait that Jeremy is talking about to get mental health care for a kid or a young adult for that matter, is that part of what you're trying to cut down on here?
It is. So, Jeremy, thank you for your comments and question. We are trying to address that wait time in a variety of different ways. And the walk-in clinic is one of the ways that we're working on that. And then in terms of young adults, you know, we were literally having that discussion earlier this morning again at Children's. And we do provide a significant amount of mental behavioral health care to young adults for a variety of reasons and issues. And we're talking about how can we do better on our own and in partnership with others so that we can provide that continuity of care into that young adulthood because that does very much matter to kids and families. And then in terms of kids with autism or other issues, I'm really happy to be able to tell you that we recently hired an excellent and fabulous doctor that is going to lead up some work for us so that we can do better taking care of kids and families with autism. So more to come on that from us, but you should be able to see some real improvements from Children's in that space.
Thanks for the call, Jeremy. Amy, the official opening of the walk-in mental health clinic was last week. I understand there was a soft opening, though, last month. How are things going so far?
Yes, you're right. We had a soft opening, and then we opened to the public last Tuesday, March 8th, and we've been busy. So we were estimating that we might see an average of 5 kids per evening. And I can tell you the first day that we were open to the public, we saw 6 kids that evening. And so we've been busy, and we've been busy dealing with individual issues that are unique to each family and helping them get that care that they need in the moment. And then, of course, after they leave the walk-in clinic as well. And so we expect to stay busy, and we will be open on weekends starting this weekend.
Amy, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for covering this. We appreciate it.
Amy Herbst is Vice President of Mental and Behavioral Health for Children's Wisconsin. She joined us to talk about the opening of the hospital's new Craig Yabuki Mental Health Walk-In Clinic. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about what it's been like to be a kid during the pandemic.
The pandemic has had a big impact on all of us, including kids. Take Cora Gruby. She's 11 years old and in the 5th grade. Here she is.
Something fun about me is I like doing my nails and I like hanging out with my friends.
Cora also really wants to do her part to help keep her family, community, and the world safe from COVID-19. She recently sat down with her stepmom, WPR's Andrea Anderson, to talk about what it's like to be a kid in the pandemic.
What is something you want people to know about kids and how their lives have changed during the pandemic?
The main thing is not being able to see friends and family. And also, during remote learning, we can't see other people as much. We really just have to stick to our family.
What does that mean for kids? What does that do to them, not being able to see those people?
It makes them pretty sad because if they can't hang out with their friends, they're pretty lonely.
How do you think kids are feeling now, 2 years into the pandemic, versus a year ago?
Well, now I think they're still really upset at the pandemic and why isn't it going away? But for the 1 year, I guess, they were just like, oh, it's okay. It's only a year of our lives. It's fine. But now that's 2 years, we don't know when it's going to stop, but we hopefully think that it's going to stop very, very soon.
And so what do you and your classmates and your friends, what do you feel about the pandemic?
Well, it's not really good, so me and my friends aren't really happy with it. I feel like maybe it's gotten me and my best friend closer because she joined the school, I think, when the pandemic was about to hit or when it already hit. So I really like the part where I met my best friend.
So we're going to turn to a subject that is a little bit polarizing in our environment right now, and that is masks. And I want to ask you, do you wear a mask? And if you do or don't, why?
I do because I'm going to try to stop the spread as much as I as an individual can.
What's it like wearing one during school or at the store?
Well, I got used to it a while ago, but at the beginning, it was really, really different because I'm used to just walking in one without remembering a mask and seeing people's faces differently, like only half of them and stuff like that.
So now we're going to talk about vaccines. And we talk a lot about the COVID-19 vaccines at home because your younger sister, Magnolia, can't be vaccinated yet. And we talked a lot about them before you were eligible to get the vaccine and before your older sister, Lucy, was eligible. And we talked about the science behind them. Did you decide to get vaccinated? And why did you make that decision, Cora?
I did get vaccinated because I really want to try to help out the world without getting anybody sick. And also especially because we have Magnolia at home and I really do not want her to get sick because she cannot get the vaccine just yet.
Is there anything else that you think people should know about the pandemic?
Well, I think people should know that me and my sister and my friends really like seeing each other. So it's like, it's kind of difficult when we can't. So we really want it to stop so we can see each other more often, because we don't want to go back onto remote learning, even though if some people just like staying in their PJs all day.
That was WPR's Andrea Anderson talking with her daughter, Cora. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, there are a lot of different explanations for why some Wisconsin basements feature a lone standing toilet. Our guest has heard of most of them. He's open to more. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We tackle a wide variety of topics on Central Time with high journalistic standards, and we keep our occasional jokes clean. No toilet humor. This next segment, no exception. We're keeping it classy, but we are talking about toilets. Basement toilets, to be specific. Have you seen one of these? Wisconsin basement, a standalone toilet, maybe a partition of some kind. Maybe it's just sitting there in the open, no sink nearby. What's it doing there? Bobby Tanzolo wanted to know. He's senior editor and writer for On Milwaukee. Bobby looked into the question. He wrote about it for the magazine. Bobby, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob. It's good to talk to you. It's going to be tough following Cora.
Definitely. Now, I've seen these in a couple places. Somebody in my wife's family had a cottage, and there was this freestanding toilet in the basement there. Moved into our current house. There's a toilet in the corner, no walls around it. Struck me odd. Never saw that in Michigan, only in Wisconsin. You've run into these too, right?
Yeah, I've only seen them in Wisconsin, but they're known to be all over the place. And in fact, one of the nicknames for them is the Pittsburgh potty. And there's a very specific couple of Pittsburgh reasons that that people call them that. So they do exist in other places. I've heard them existing in the southeast of the country, all throughout the Midwest. So they are not unique to Milwaukee, it turns out.
But you started asking around in the Milwaukee area. A lot of people have run into this, right?
Yeah, you know, I grew up in New York City and I never saw one. So when I moved to Milwaukee and we moved into my grandparents' house, they had one in the basement that had sort of a makeshift partition and door, which seemed weird enough to me. But then I came across these other houses where the toilet was just by itself out in the middle of the basement, maybe next to the washing machine, you know, just sitting there. And I thought, what could this possibly be for? Because obviously you think any toilet is for a very specific use.
Right.
But why would anyone want to use that sitting out in the open in the basement?
Right under a window, actually, in both the cases I mentioned. Okay, so you started digging into this, Bobby. There are multiple theories about this. What are some of the most common answers you ran into?
Well, the most common one that I have come across in Wisconsin, and also from it's one of the Pittsburgh things, is that it was called a dad's toilet, or was for working men who came home and could go in through a basement entrance and clean up before they came into the living area of the house. And actually, a plumber that I spoke to said that often they do see a shower head next to them above a floor drain, but again, with no partitions, no frills, just like basically a shower head sticking out of a pipe. So that is obviously a reason. This is definitely a reason they exist in some cases, and is also an effect. We just don't know that it's a cause for why they're there. You know, if there, you would use it, right? But that might not be why they're there, because if you don't mind me going on, I'll tell
you.
Sure,
go for it. Yeah, this is an interesting one.
Yeah, the Pittsburgh potty explanation is that in Western Pennsylvania, and this is apparently the case in other places, where they were not floor drains, apparently, in the basements. So when there were sewer backups, the lowest fixture in the house would be the one that would back up. So you would put a toilet in the basement so that if the sewer backed up, that one would back up into the basement rather than your toilet upstairs backing up into your living quarters. That may or may not be an explanation here because we do have floor drains, but we haven't always had floor drains. So it's possible that some of them existed for that reason before floor drains became common here. Again, with any of these explanations, there's as many questions for each one. Like, why, if it was just a simple thing to for a backup situation, why wouldn't you just have a pipe in the corner sticking out of the floor? Why would you pay to have a toilet? You know, why isn't it a sink? Why, you know what I mean? There are questions.
Now, that first answer was mostly geared toward maybe a working class family. Like you said, you get home from the factory, you got some facilities down there. There's another thought that some houses, maybe more middle or upper middle class homes, they were there not for the residents, though, but for people they might have hired to do jobs there.
Yes. So I spoke to a woman who lives on the Upper East Side of Milwaukee in a house that was anything but a working class house. I mean, you often see them in working class houses, but they do also exist in these upper middle class houses and upper class houses where they were believed to be for the help. Often, some people suggested it was for gardeners who were working outside. They could come in through the basement and entrance, again, not mess up the house. Some people said they were for servants who perhaps lived in the house, or maybe even just cooks who came for the day and then left, you know. It's hard to say for sure. It sounds like a good explanation. In most of the upper class 19th and early 20th century houses that I've been in for stories, they're generally servants' quarters on the third floor, and typically they have facilities of their own up there. But I guess it could be for servants who came and didn't actually live on site.
Now, at the heart of all this for me, Bobby, is the existence of these toilets, again, often without any partition, points toward a different attitude, I guess, toward privacy than I grew up with. Did people think about this stuff different back then? Do you wonder about that?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely sounds like it, because loads of people who have commented on the story on social media have said they had them in the basement, out in the open. I mean, some were partitioned, but even people who had them out in the open said that they were used. So people were not ashamed, apparently, to use these. I don't know if there was some sort of signal for letting people know. You know, if you heard the door open from upstairs, you're
saying
like,
the whole time. I don't know. Have you run it? So you get three main theories there. Any other explanations that people have offered to you as you're writing the piece or since?
Yeah, no, I had a good one that actually is in the piece from Thomas Hubke, who was a professor emeritus at UWM, who coincidentally recently wrote a book about how working class houses came to be and how they sort of grew into how they became modern, I think is the title, How Working Class Houses Became Modern. And he talks about the three fixture bathroom being such a huge thing, a huge change, the sink, toilet, you know, that setup and the bathtub in working class houses is a big change, because initially, of course, there might not be plumbing and the toilet would be out in the backyard. And Tom says that often in his research, he found that the first toilet installed in a house, and this is generally old houses, was installed in the basement, because it was definitely a step up from going out in the backyard. So it was seen as an improvement anyway, but also it was much cheaper to put it in the basement.
Less plumbing.
And not spend the money to redecorate and plumb upstairs.
Now, Bobby,
so it's possible that some of the older ones were actually the first, and I've had anecdotally people tell me in comments on social media that the first and only toilet in their house was that basement toilet.
Ah, now you are, I think, still collecting stories. If people have a story to share of their own experience with a basement freestanding toilet.
Oh, absolutely. If people want to tell me more, I'm happy to update the story and keep it going. Of course, everybody says it's there for the obvious reason. But again, I think in a lot of cases that the use of the toilet that's there is an effect rather than the cause.
And how can people reach you with their stories?
Oh, they can email me at Bobby, B-O-B-B-Y, at onmilwaukee.com.
Bobby at onmilwaukee.com.
Yeah.
Bobby, thanks so much for sharing. You always have the most fascinating research from your urban spelunking project. Thank you.
Thank you. I really wanted to flush this one out.
That's Bobby Tadzalow, senior editor and writer for On Milwaukee. He joined us for a look at why some Wisconsin basements feature standalone toilets. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, is it possible to change our personalities on purpose? Our guest tried to do it in 3 months. Find out what she learned about herself and what we can learn from her project. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.